Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Before we get going here, I just want to pass a little weather information on to you, provided by our forecaster, Mike Sola. We are now expecting the possibility of some heavy rain in our listening area today, with occasional showers and maybe some thunderstorms this morning and the periods of heavy rainfall possible this afternoon. And now an urban and small stream flood warning has been issued for Clark and Cumberland counties that will be in effect until 9:30 tonight. That's in addition to the flood watch in effect for Champaign, Christian, Clark, Coles, Cumberland, Douglas, Edgar, Macon, Moultrie, Piatt, Shelby, and Vermilion counties through Wednesday morning. If we have more information on weather, we'll pass it on to you. Certainly, if there is any severe weather, we'll make sure that you know all about that. Our next complete look at the weather comes as part of the afternoon magazine at 12:35 this afternoon. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about Saudi Arabia and the relationship between the governments of Saudi Arabia and the United States. Saudi Arabia controls a quarter of the world's proven oil reserves, and as a result, the United States had a decades-long interest in the stability of the Saudi regime. This morning, we'll review a little bit of the history of this relationship as we talk with Steve Yateev. He's professor of political science at Old Dominion University. That's in Norfolk, Virginia. We'll be talking a bit about the politics of the Persian Gulf and the involvement there of the United States and about how both of those are involved in global energy stability. And of course, questions and comments are welcome from people who are listening. Let me tell you just a little bit more about our guest. He's regularly interviewed by national and international media. He's traveled widely in the Middle East, has published more than 200 editorial pieces. His books, and he's authored a number of them, focus on the American role in the Middle East and also on global energy. They include The Persian Gulf Crisis, which won a Choice Award for Outstanding Academic Book in 1998, Explaining Foreign Policy, that looked at the decisions that took the U.S. to war in the Persian Gulf in 91 and 2003, Crude Awakenings, Global Oil Security and American Foreign Policy, that looks at global oil security, and also he's the author of a book that is scheduled to come out this year from the Johns Hopkins University Press. That book is titled The Absence of Grand Strategy, The United States and the Persian Gulf. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Questions and comments are certainly welcome from listeners. We just ask people to try to keep their comments brief so that we can keep moving along and get in as many different people as possible. But again, questions welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Yateev, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
I first would like to talk a little bit about the price of oil. We have seen here an historic run-up in the price. It's been at 110. I think it backed off a little bit from that. I'm not sure where it is today, but certainly one of the things we can say is roughly over the last year, the price has doubled. And there are some people who have gone as far as to predict we could see $150 barrel of oil. If you ask the question, what's led to this price increase, you ask different people, you're going to get different answers. What would your answer be? Why has oil gone up so much?
The first answer is that global demand has gone up and it's projected to increase. So demand is putting pressure on price. But since February of 2007, as you've mentioned, the price of oil on the New York Mercantile Exchange has gone up from 50 to, and now I think about 108 or 9 this morning. And you can't explain that simply by looking at demand and supply. There's more going on. The two other major things that have increased oil prices are fear of so-called geopolitical events or instability in other areas. Usually these are false fears, but they do drive the price of oil up, such as the Turkish invasion of northern Iraq, the threat from Venezuela's Hugo Chavez that will cut off oil to the United States, and in the past year also some concerns that the United States would attack Iran. But more important than that, we've had in the last year something like the oil rush. You know, we had a gold rush, but an oil rush, which is that a lot of money has gone into hedge funds and other types of organizations, which eventually put their money into oil futures. So there's actually a lot more money now chasing oil, and that's part because, in part because people are using that as a hedge against a market that's gone down. So there's a lot more activity in oil funds, and we can trace that. Also, the dollar has gone down, and when the dollar is lower, then foreigners look at oil as relatively more cheap because oil is traded in dollars. So if the value of the dollar is down, oil itself becomes cheaper to buy, and so foreigners now are buying a lot more into oil, adding to this oil rush. So we have global demand, we have foreign events, and we have speculation and a lot of money going into the oil patch. And that's causing these very high prices.
Mm-hmm. One of the things, certainly the price of oil is of great concern to the government of the United States. And one of the ways that this administration has tried to address that is to deal with the supply side of things. And in fact, not very long ago, President Bush was in Saudi Arabia, and he made the pitch to the Saudi government to increase the supply by pumping more oil. And apparently the Saudis weren't particularly interested in helping out the United States. In fact, I think they went as far as to say, well, it's not their problem if oil is that expensive. It's basically our problem because the dollar is weak. And I think, in fact, some Saudi government spokespeople or representatives went as far as to say, well, the problem really is mismanagement of the American economy, and we're not going to be able to solve this problem for you by pumping more oil. Now, again, you can take that apart and look at what the Saudi motivation is here. But just let me just have you address that particular point, and that is, to what extent, even if we could get the Saudis to pump more oil, would that really help?
Well, they're right in a sense that the problem with the American economy now is the housing bubble and the credit crisis more than oil prices. But oil prices certainly contribute to the problem because especially people who have less money, if they have to spend more on gasoline, we'll spend less in buying things from the economy. So while oil is not the fundamental problem, it is certainly contributing to recessionary problems. So they're right in a sense, but wrong in another. There was a time when the Saudis would pump more oil along with their OPEC colleagues when the price of oil got too high. I mean, I was in at OPEC headquarters in 2001, which is in Vienna, Austria, and the leaders there were telling me that they're very proud that they have kept oil in their OPEC price band of around $28 to $31 per barrel. Now, their oil is different from NYMEX, but now it's almost three and a half, four times what they were proud of in 2001, and global conditions have not changed that much. Mm-hmm. So there's something else that's keeping them from raising production, and it's partly it's because, strangely enough, we are more efficient at using oil now than we were in the past. It's something called oil intensity, which means that it measures how much oil is needed to produce a unit of gross domestic product. And we need 30% less now than we did in 1970. So to say that oil is at 110, if you adjust for that, it's really at something like 80. But still, that is very high. And in a period of recession, you would expect the Saudis and OPEC to pump more oil. So there's something else going on there, and there's actually many reasons that a colleague of mine and I sketched in an op-ed in Christian Science Monitor. We could go into those reasons, but to sum it up, you know, they've got a burgeoning population. Their budget sheet is not as strong as people think at home. They may want to cash in on high prices, and there's at least a minor possibility that the Saudis don't have the kind of oil that people think for in the next 25, 30 years. So they may be shifting slightly to a policy of trying to cash in now. Mm-hmm. So it's a very complex picture, but OPEC really should step up to the plate here because I think that they are miscalculating because oil is part of our problem. And if the prices keep going up and their failure to act is associated with a U.S. recession, which then feeds into global problems, they'll be blamed in part.
Yeah. I do think that was an interesting piece, and I did look at it, and I think perhaps some people, the thing that would interest them most is this suggestion that the Saudis are actually thinking about, no one really knows how much oil they have, and if they know, they're not saying. Mm-hmm. But there is this, some people do suspect that they're getting to the point, it's not like they're going to run out of oil tomorrow, mm-hmm. but that they're getting to the point where they realize that production has plateaued and mm-hmm. that they're not, it's not going to go up more, and all it can do in the fullness of time is to go down. Mm-hmm. So that, if in fact that was true, that would be a very significant thing, not just for them, but for the world.
That would be very significant. I know some people think that has happened. I think it's a possibility, but I wouldn't put that possibility over 20%. But even at 20%, it's a very serious problem, because if they actually have less than the 260 billion barrels that they declare, that means that the world is going to reach its plateau much sooner than people think. And that doesn't mean that you'll go to the gas station and people say, hey, sorry, you know, no gas for you today. Mm-hmm. But it does mean that once the markets realize that this plateau has been reached, they'll drive prices higher. Yeah. So we really need to get on the ball ahead of that and get into alternatives more seriously.
Well, that's, I think, gets to another point. I want to at least touch on it, and then I do want to make sure that we talk about the politics of the Persian Gulf. That I don't want this conversation to be all about oil. But having said all that, I think that when people think about the reality of oil and who has it and who needs it, they say, well, obviously they have it, that is the Saudis have a lot of it, and not just them, but OPEC has it, and we need it, so that means they have all the cards. So the question is, well, is that in fact the case, and does the United States have any kind of leverage here at all?
Definitely. I think that is one of the unrealized sources of American power, which is that the American economy uses one quarter of the world's oil. That means that we can affect the price of oil significantly. Imagine if you bought one quarter of some item out there and then you decided you weren't going to buy as much of it. The price would go down. If the United States puts in motion a serious energy policy that decreases the amount of oil it uses from 21 million barrels per day of the world's 84 million per day. Imagine what a number. If it reduces that by just 3 or 4 million barrels, and that's not a simple thing to do, but it's doable, that will drive the price of oil down from currently projected levels. And that can really affect the power of a cartel like OPEC.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Steve Yateev. He's professor of political science at Old Dominion University. That's in Norfolk, Virginia. And in his work, he's interested in the American role in the Middle East, in global energy and interdependence, and also theories of foreign policy and international relations. And here we have been talking about a little bit about the price of oil. We also want to talk about Saudi Arabia and the relationship between Saudi Arabia, the government of Saudi Arabia, and the government of the United States. And questions or comments are welcome. We just ask people to be brief. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here in a nearby community of Belgium. It's our line number 4, the toll free line. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I know, Mr. Inge, you said you're going to talk about the politics of the area, but that seems to me that should be foremost. This war that we're fighting over there has definitely got to affect this whole situation. Not only because of the war, but because of the amount of money we are investing, or I don't know if we are actually investing it. We seem to be getting all kinds of tax rebates, but we don't seem to be paying for this war. I think that should have a high priority on this discussion.
All right, well, we can go there. Professor Yateev, you want to talk about the Iraq war and the politics of the region?
Well, you know, the administration got into the 1991 war with Saddam Hussein largely because of oil. They didn't want Saddam to have control of that, of the region, and the U.S. is largely responsible for that region after the British withdrawal from the region in the 70s. But this 2003 war, I don't believe, was an oil war. I think oil might have been a fourth reason down the list, and I don't think it was terrorism, really. I think that after 9/11, the administration was really concerned that Saddam Hussein had WMD. And I guess that was linked to terrorism, not in the sense that al-Qaeda was in Iraq, but that Saddam would give WMD to terrorists. And that's what drove it. I'm not exactly sure what question was being asked, but if it was to what extent oil is wrapped up in this war, that's how I would see it.
Well, what I was meaning, sir, is that We have invested, almost a trillion dollars in this war.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, that has an effect on everything we buy, sell, we finance, everything. And we've not paid for this war by coming to the populace and taxing us like we did in World War II and different other wars. We've just financed it on the back of investors from the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, that has to have an effect on all kinds of commodities.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Well, I think chiefly what it's going to do is drive the U.S. deficit up. We've paid for it with deficit spending, and the United States has a huge problem with deficit spending, and this will worsen that for sure. But I don't think that the high cost of the war is what's driving the price of oil up. In fact, the fact that the U.S. is in Iraq probably is keeping somewhat oil from going even higher. Because if the U.S. got out of Iraq, then the fears would be that the region is going to unravel. And if the region is going to unravel, oil will be less safe, and then the price will go up. That's not to say that it was sensible to go into Iraq. I think looking back now, it was a major strategic blunder, in part because it threw the balance of power out in the region. It made Iran much stronger. Although the good news is in the last 6 months, things have gotten at least better off of not good levels.
Thank you very much, sir.
You're welcome. We have someone next on a cell phone calling from Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. I have a small question. The question is, what will happen to the normal Saudis, the Saudi citizens, when their oil has been exhausted? I mean, we are sucking the oil out, their revenues out. What will happen to those normal people, except for the princes?
Yeah, that's a good question. I should emphasize, I don't think the Saudis are going to run out of oil anytime soon. It's really a question of whether they've got a 30-year supply or a 60-year supply, something like that. But the Saudis already see the writing on the wall, and at least starting around 5 years ago, they've tried to move their economy off of being simply a one-trick pony of oil. So they're trying to diversify already, and they're building their infrastructure for diversification. They're trying to globalize, and they're trying to prepare for a future in which oil is less critical. What they don't know, and no one knows, is if the price of oil really rises high, whether some really effective alternative can be brought to the market. I mean, there's a lot of work already being done on it, these things, and the higher the price of oil goes, the higher the chance of these alternatives. So they have to, even if they have oil for the next 30 or 60 years, they don't know if that oil is going to be worth that much 30 or 50 years from now. So they're already moving in that direction in order to deal with that. But there's no doubt that if they lose those revenues from oil in a way that they don't expect, that the average citizens will really be hurt, because as the callers may be suggesting, the Saudi society is cradle to grave. The people are taken care of from cradle to grave for all the services that they get.
I mean, there is no infrastructure development. All what they do is, taking debts. This is their only industry.
Mm-hmm. Well, look at Dubai. Dubai, for instance, is now becoming the tourist mecca of the Middle East. It's building the equivalent of 10 Disneylands all in one place called Dubai Land. And that's going to attract a lot of tourism to Dubai, even though Dubai, as part of the United Arab Emirates, does have a lot of oil and makes a lot of money from oil. So good leadership in that region will be leadership that slowly diversifies the economies away from being just reliant on oil.
All right. Well, I thank the caller. And again, others who are listening are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I'd like to have you talk a little bit about the relationship between the Saudi government and the United States, and perhaps how that has changed over time. And I think that overall, in spite of the fact that the two governments have always talked about being important friends and allies, it seems to me that this has always been something of a marriage of convenience and not a love match. That it's one where there has been, it maybe not publicly, but it seems that over the last 5-10 years, maybe a little bit more tension or strain than there has been in the past.
Yeah. Well, the two countries started in earnest their oil relations in the 40s, but it was not until the 1970s that the United States started to get very interested in the Persian Gulf. In 1968, the British announced they would withdraw from the region because their economy was flagging. Excuse me, I have a little bit of a cold. Their economy was flagging, and they had some political problems in the region. So the United States took over as the responsibility for the Gulf. In the 70s, though, the United States counted on Saudi Arabia and Iran as the twin pillars in President Nixon's twin-pillar policy. It gave them all kinds of support, Iran, all kinds of arms for them to protect the region, and chiefly Iran to protect the region. But in 79, Iran went down to the Iranian Revolution. And then the United States had to prepare very rapidly for its own intervention in the region. In 1981, this is the key year for U.S.-Saudi relations, the two countries made a secret agreement that the United States would build major forces in case the Saudis were challenged by Iran or Saddam, and those forces would come to help the Saudis if they had such a problem, and the Saudis would build massive strategic infrastructure. And this was part of a big strategic package that included the sale of American AWACS aircraft and F-15 aircraft to the Saudis and Saudi support on the oil issue. So that took off in 1981. No one knew, however, that those facilities wouldn't be used against the Soviets coming from Afghanistan that they invaded, from Iran that had just been taken over by the revolutionaries. No one had expected that they would actually be used a decade later against Saddam, although they feared Saddam a little bit. So the basis of the U.S.-Saudi relationship is really that strategic agreement of 1981. Now, that agreement was shaken by September 11 for a lot of complex reasons, but namely because the Saudis started to see the U.S. as a liability at home with all this potential turmoil from terrorists, and the United States started to see the Saudis as potentially unstable as a strategic basing ground because they didn't know if Al-Qaeda was, you know, just one cockroach or it represented a lot more problems on the Saudi domestic scene. So that strategic agreement still exists, but it's been shaken, and the U.S. forces have left Saudi Arabia as of 2003. But they could re-enter and would certainly re-enter again if the Saudis were threatened in any major way like they were when Iraq invaded Kuwait in 1990.
We have another caller here. It's someone here where we are in Champaign County. They're up next, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I think one of your books is something called About a Lack of a Grand Strategy. That makes me think that you, of course, know about the grand area planning and Kennan's post-World War II, you know, the prize that mm-hmm. Middle East oil has to be under U.S. hegemony. So with that said, how can you say that the first Gulf War was about oil? I mean, you're talking about the oil in Kuwait.
Mm-hmm.
But now you're saying that the Saudis don't even know how much they really have left, and we're talking about getting past the peak production, the easy production of oil, that why wouldn't this also fundamentally be about oil? And the WMD idea is I just can't believe that it's still being offered because there was a great campaign to make people believe that, but if they really were worried about WMDs, they would have continued the inspection. They went to war, rushed to war, and threw the inspectors out because they were worried about their casus belli being undermined. So I just can't... It seems you can't have it both ways, I would say.
Yeah, I think the 2003 war was related to oil possibly in this sense, in the sense is that the U.S. government was concerned that the Saudis were unstable, so if that were the case, it would make more sense than to go into Iraq to try to stabilize Iraq as an oil outlet, given that Iraq's the second biggest producer in the world. But if you look at the record very, very carefully, if you look at before September 11 and after September 11, before, after, it becomes abundantly clear that the administration is not just concerned, but there's a real fear. There's a real fear there as they look around the world after 9/11. There's a fear that there'll be a very bad marriage. And that very bad marriage will be WMD and terrorism, because 911 was terrorism, but without WMD. But the great fear was, what if it were with weapons of mass destruction? So they looked around the world and they thought, well, you know, who represents someone who has been working on WMD for a long time, who kicked inspectors out in 1998, who did not reveal, you know, everything that many thought that he had. And their intelligence services, as well as those of others around the world, got it wrong for a very tricky, interesting reason, which was that Saddam was actually pretending that he had these things when he didn't. But anyway, they thought that this was the case. And they also wanted to take him down anyway because he had violated UN resolutions for so many years, and he was a thorn in their foreign policy approach. So I think the historical record will show they really believed there was WMD. They trumped up the nuclear aspect of it to some extent. They trumped up the terrorism aspect of it. There was also some deception, misinformation, purposeful confiscation of information, because they actually wanted to take him down. And I think we'll find out that there were other reasons, too.
Well, the former Treasury Secretary, who we wish we had back now, I guess, but said that Iraq regime change, forcible regime change, was on the docket the first meeting that he attended at the White House.
My book that's coming out, Absence of Grand Strategy, very, very carefully looks at the evolution of American foreign policy. And you're absolutely right that as of 1998, the official policy of the United States was regime change in Iraq. This is true out of Congress. President Clinton stated it. But I interviewed some of the people involved, looked at a lot of things. What happened was that the United States had that as an idea, but they lacked a number of things. They lacked the event that could mobilize public support to actually go into Iraq, and that was very critical. And they also lacked the kind of dramatic reason to go in and get rid of Saddam. So although it was official policy from 1998, it was only after 2001 that it changed from what was called containment plus, which is to contain Saddam, which is what they were doing from 1990s until 98. It became containment plus, contain him, and alt plus regime change. It changed from that to outright regime change with force.
Well, the 1998 regime change law called, it was debated on the Hill as to whether it should include a covert destabilization, money for military destabilization, mm-hmm. of Iraq, and that was argued on the Hill, and amazingly enough, they voted it out. The Bush administration came in with the belligerent attitude that they wanted to do it by any means necessary, and as you admit, it was discussed at the very beginning of the presidency before 9/11. A lot of the surveillance stuff went into effect before the administration before 9/11. So it isn't everything changed at 9/11, except as you just pointed out, they needed something dramatic to justify the
Well, you're definitely right about that. I mean, even in 1996, the CIA was trying to overthrow Saddam Hussein in northern Iraq, but the operation went awry. So they've been trying to get rid of him, but you know, your point is well taken. It's not like one night everything changes there, but there was a very dramatic difference after 9/11, which is that they thought they could get public support and they wanted to use force. That is very different from trying to use the CIA for covert operations, trying to get him assassinated, support a coup. All those things are dramatically different than actually thinking that you could take a massive army into a country and rebuild it. And it was only without 9/11, there is no way that they could have done that. And even with 9/11, if Al Gore had won the presidency, his national security advisor, Leon Firth, and Gore said they would never have gone there.
I need to jump in here. I have another caller, and we're already past our midpoint, and I'd like to introduce again our guest for anybody who might have tuned in the last 5 or 10 minutes. We're talking with Steve Yativ. He's professor of political science at Old Dominion University. That's in Norfolk, Virginia, and has authored a number of books that look at the American role in the Middle East and also global energy, just to mention a couple. Explaining Foreign Policy, that was a book that looked at the decisions that took the U.S. to war in the Persian Gulf in 1991 and 2003, Crude Awakenings, Global Oil Security, and American Foreign Policy. That book looks at global oil security. He's also the author of the book yet to be published but scheduled to come out this year from Johns Hopkins. That book is The Absence of Grand Strategy, The United States and the Persian Gulf, 1972 to 2005. And we've been talking here about oil energy policy, and also about the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Just to go back to a second to one of the things that you talked about was one of the results of 9/11 was, as far as the United States was concerned, was concerns about the stability of Saudi Arabia. Can you talk a little bit about that, and are there threats to Saudi stability? And I guess here what we're talking about is the current ruling family and the current Saudi regime. Any serious internal threats?
Well, I think that the threats are largely overblown. But after September 11, it really was not clear how stable they were. Because the idea that emerged was, after we learned that 15 of the 19 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia, the question arose, well, do they represent a population that's sympathetic to their idea? Because Al-Qaeda wants to get rid of the Saudis as much as it wants to get rid of the U.S. So it took some time to try to figure out if this was an isolated radical movement or something that had the broader sympathy of the population. And what polls have suggested is that the Saudi population has some sympathy with Al-Qaeda, some of Al-Qaeda's goals, but 95% of the Saudis would not want bin Laden running the country. But at the time, we didn't really have a sense of that. So there was a real concern that the Saudis were in trouble. Now, your broader question is, how stable is the regime? People have been predicting the demise of that regime for decades. And, you know, if you wait long enough, anything might happen. But the fact of the matter is that they are loaded with cash that they can use to pay off their enemies at home. They can use brutal repression to attack their enemies. They have cracked down heavily on Al-Qaeda. They have taken a lot of actions to deal with some of the broader sympathies that Al-Qaeda can obtain. And so the threat, it's hard to predict, but it seems like that all the predictions over the past four decades have largely fallen flat, that they would be eliminated. Now there, that doesn't mean everything's hunky-dory over there. There are some severe problems. That is that they have a young population, one-third of their population under 25. They have an unemployment rate that's over 10%. They have a budget that's been, despite all their oil, stretched over the past 15 years. They actually ran budget deficits in the 90s. And they have a royal family which is not as hated as some people think, but it's not loved either. Plus, they do have an Al-Qaeda presence that has been trying to bomb their oil installations, but has only managed to bomb residential compounds that are on the outskirts of those facilities. So there are different aspects on the scene, but if you asked me, they largely have them under control, but they could face a problem down the road if they do not deal with their burgeoning young population. Mm.
Let's talk with some other callers. We have a couple here in Urbana. The next in line is on line two right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, you said that we've been talking about regime change since 96 or something. I was wondering if you could sort of lay out that if these various people in the administration had gotten exactly what they wanted, what form it would have taken, and whether any of them would not have increased the power of Iran?
Yeah, good question. Just to give you kind of a quick background, the United States kicked Iraq out of Kuwait in 1991, And after that, it had a policy of containing Iraq, but that's it, just to contain it. And that's what a lot of people wanted the U.S. to continue to do instead of to invade Iraq in 2003. But along with containing Iraq, there were some efforts to get rid of Saddam Hussein. One was a CIA effort that I referred to before, the CIA cooperating with one Kurdish group in northern Iraq to try to destabilize Saddam, his regime. The goal in 1996 and thereafter was just to try to see if they could get a coup against him, a couple of his generals that hate him, they could help them get rid of him, but that Iraq would otherwise remain largely the same. It would just have one, you know, general taken over instead of Saddam. And maybe it would change over time. By 1998, the Congress and the president had switched the policy to outright official regime change. In other words, they wanted Saddam out, they wanted a new regime in, but there was no suggestion that the U.S. would ever use force to do it. After 9/11, the ideas that had been around that maybe force could be used, and that had been argued, you know, behind the scenes, now came out into the public domain and became real, whereas before they were more potential.
And the caller also asked the question about, and you talked about the fact that one of the outcomes of the Iraq War has been an enhancing of the power of in the region of Iran. I think she raised the question was, would that have happened no matter what kind of intervention the United, if what the United States was concerned with was regime change, would that have, no matter what, would that have enhanced the power of Iran?
Oh, good question. No, no. I think there were many different ways that would have produced different outcomes. The thing that led to Iran becoming so strong is that not only was Saddam, the strong man of Iraq, eliminated, but essentially the backbone of his entire military was eliminated. In effect, the United States decided to rebuild Iraq all the way down to the battalions that had been Sunni-led by Sunni generals. And so many people think that was a mistake, that the U.S. could have gone in, gotten rid of Saddam, but kept the key elements of his military intact. But the reason Iran's so strong is because not only is Saddam gone, but his military is now being rebuilt, and it's, you know, 1/20th the size of what it was. And, of course, Iraq has been in disarray, and a country in disarray cannot really balance against the next-door strong Iran. So because of that, Iran has become stronger. It has become so strong compared to Iraq that the Arabs are nervous about Iran, because Iran's Persian, and historically the Persians and the Arabs have not gotten along so well. So the Arab countries like Saudi Arabia have been so nervous about Iran that Saudis even showed up in Jerusalem to talk to the Israelis about Iran, because the Saudis are as nervous about Iran's nuclear program as the Israelis. So if you can get Saudis showing up in Jerusalem, you know something strange is going on in the Middle East.
Well, that was one of the other major areas that I wanted to have you talk about, and that is Saudi concerns about threats from outside and who it is when the Saudis look around their region, who it is that makes them nervous. And it sounds as if you would say, well, probably number one on the list right now would be Iran.
Yeah, the Saudis, I would say, have this list. The first is their home, at home. That makes them most nervous, because we know from history that powerful leaders are overthrown most of the time from inside, not from outside. So at first they're looking at, you know, is there an al-Qaeda presence? Who supports al-Qaeda? They have it under control, but they're nervous. After that, Iran for sure is up there on their list. And then after that, strangely enough, the Shia-led Iraq. Because this is the first time in history that the Middle East has had a Shia-led government outside of Iran that the Arab world has, and the Shias and the Sunnis have had troubles in the past, although in some places they get along just fine. So third, I think, would be Iraq, and then a distant fourth would be Israel, although they're not concerned about Israel attacking them so much as complicating some of their own politics.
So given that, then What does that mean? Their concerns, maybe homegrown opponents, and not something that the United States is much of in a position to address. But if they're concerned about the power of Iran and of an Iraq led by Shia and possibly Israel, or how that conflict plays into the politics of the region, that maybe would suggest that if they really are concerned about all those external factors, that might lead them to want to hold the United States a little bit closer, or put more importance on this relationship than it has?
I think it's fair to say the more they're concerned about external threats, the more they come close to the U.S., but while they are concerned about Iran more than they were before, they are less concerned about Iraq than they were before. And this is because although Iraq is Shia-led, it doesn't have the strong military that Saddam had. So all things equal, they were more concerned about Saddam, even though he was a Sunni, because he had a giant military and was ambitious, than they are about the Shia-led Iran, which is problematic ideologically, but they don't have the military to do anything, and the U.S. is there. So things are kind of countervailing. They're more concerned about Iran, they're still concerned about Iraq, but less, and those two things are sort of canceling each other out. So overall, they don't need the U.S. any more than they did in the past.
We have about 7-8 minutes left in this part of the show. Again, I'd like to introduce their guest, Steve Yatif. He's professor of political science at Old Dominion University. That's in Norfolk, Virginia, and has written a lot on the American role in the Middle East and also on global energy security. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I'm interested in having you say a couple of things about what we know about the way that people in Saudi Arabia feel about the United States. And the reason that I ask the question is that in reading and trying to get ready for our conversation, I seem to see stories that say conflicting things, that say on the one hand that anti-Americanism is at unprecedented levels in Saudi Arabia, and on the other hand that in recent years, in fact, it has been lessening, and that Saudis actually feel more positive about the United States. And I'm confused because I'm reading both things. Do you think it is?
Well, we have some polling information. It's never clear just how accurate it is, but the polling information suggests that the U.S. reputation in Muslim countries has dropped substantially since the invasion of Iraq, that data is pretty convincing, and it also holds for Saudi Arabia. So I would have to say the U.S. is less popular in Saudi Arabia now than it was before it invaded Iraq. Although it's always had somewhat of a problem with the Saudi population. The strange thing is that the Iranian public is more pro-American than the Saudi public, but the Iranian regime is more anti-American than the Saudi regime. So the United States has always had positive relations with the Saudi regime, and if the United States got what it wanted, the saying, don't ask for something too much because you might get it, if the United States actually got what it wanted in Saudi Arabia, which is democracy, then the Saudi regime would probably be a lot less friendly to the United States, because the polling suggests that the Saudi public is a lot less friendly to the U.S. than the regime itself.
All right. Well, we'll go on here. We have time for one or two calls. We'll try to get in as many as we can. And next, we'll talk with someone in Kankakee. This is our line 4. Hello.
Yes, sir. Hello. Is this Steve?
Yeah.
Yeah, hi. My first name is Joe. I got in late on your thanks for taking my call, first
sure.
of all. But I get in late on your program and so forth. But I'd like to point out a couple things that might not be great. But, the CIA, are you really in love with them?
No. Why would you think that?
And the CIA is the mafia in this country. Okay, now we'll go on to one more step, and I'm not telling you what to say on the radio, but a dear friend of mine, he's a young man, 8 years old, his buddies are over in Iraq, And right now, this one is 26 years old. He says, you know, he says, we're getting prostate cancer like you cannot believe, whatever the hell they're getting into.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's worse than horrendous. A young man getting prostate cancer, and he says, many of us are getting it, and that's the guys that are there.
Yeah, I don't think they're the mafia, although I think some of their tactics that they use are mafia-like. I think their problem is more that they need to be more effective. That's the bigger problem. Our intelligence services need to be more effective, but there are some excellent people in our intelligence services. They are very diligent, they work hard, but the system, I think, is broken. And part of the reason it's broken is because the right hand doesn't know what the left hand's doing. The CIA doesn't talk to the FBI. The CIA is only like 15% of the intelligence community. There's intelligence services everywhere. Congress has it, the Senate has it, National Intelligence Council, Department of Defense has an intelligence service. They don't coordinate enough. If they coordinated more, they'd be able to connect the dots more, and they'd be able to prevent more terrorist activity. I think the bigger problem is not that they're mafia, but that they got to be more effective.
Yeah. Again, I appreciate the comments of the call. Let's go on to Urbana for the next line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to revisit a couple points. One was the increase in oil prices that I sort of ballparked these things. And I came up with about a 40% contribution of currency adjustments and about 30% for speculation. And this is speculation that is new from hedge funds fleeing the subprime debacle.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really, so far, if the dollar poor economic policies of the Bush administration have had a lot to do with the decline in the dollar, and that has had a lot to do with the increase, and then, again, poor economic policies, the other side of it, 30%. But, again, these are have very little to do with supply and demand issues.
Mm-hmm.
And the other part of it was that in terms of the supply and demand, when you talk about, you know, the Saudis turning on the spigot or something, first off, you have to say how much could they turn it on, and it's probably only about 500,000 barrels. The days where they could do a million or 2 million, I think, are pretty much gone. And you also have to ask yourself how long could they do it.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing would be basically, what would be the oil that they would be turning on? Because, of course, the one thing that has not been mentioned in this discussion is that oil is not a homogeneous substance.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if the Saudis start pumping heavier crudes, that may not have very much effect on us. You know, it will do us no good.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think historically what you're referring to, spare capacity, how much they can produce up and beyond what they're producing regularly, like in a crisis, that's at a low. And I think that what they could produce now, some of it would be heavy crude, which many refineries around the world cannot handle. So I think that is true. They are trying to ramp up now to produce 1.5 million barrels more within a few years. And they'll probably be able to do that. It's not, in my view, it's not a question of a short-run crunch, although we don't know for sure. But it's a question of down the road, will they be able to deal with this continuing global demand, which, because of China and India, is rising. Let's look at just one statistic. China has four times the population of the United States. It has 1/30th the number of vehicles on the road. And it's industrializing, and that's where 60% of the world's oil is used, in vehicles. So if we do the math, you know, we see a rising global demand, and the question about whether the Saudis can continue to service that enough to keep oil prices from rising is a real question.
Well, we touched on the factors that the caller raises. We touched on all these things at the very beginning of the conversation. I don't know if you were necessarily ranking them in order of importance, when you look at the supply side of things, the willingness of the Saudis and other nations to pump or their ability to pump more, and then the other things, particularly the weak dollar and speculation, if you size up which of those two major groups is going to be more responsible for the run-up in the price? Do you want to say which you think it is?
Yeah, that's a real, real tough question. But I would say that 60% of the price is rising global demand, demand supply, economic fundamentals. And then, the rest of the percentage, I would say probably 20% speculation, and 20% the dollar.
Mm. Well, I want to try and get one more caller here, and I thank the last person. Let's go to Monticello, line number two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Do you think that war profiteering had any motivational aspect in deciding to go to full-scale war in Iraq? I mean, it certainly seems that it has become important as the war has worn on. Companies have made fortunes. Individuals have made fortunes as a result of the war.
Yeah, earlier I mentioned there might be some other things we'll find out. Yeah, it's quite possible, of course, that large companies thought that they could benefit from the conflict. The real question is, how did that feed? To what extent was that at play? And how did it feed into the actual policy process? Because the policy to go into Iraq was made by very few people in the White House, and so did large companies try to influence them? Did they themselves think that they wanted to benefit large companies? But however you cut the cake, I would put that as one of these tertiary or lower level reasons, whatever we do discover. And I still do hold that the administration was really, I don't want to say frightened, but there was a real fear in the White House after 9/11. They looked around the world, they saw where a bad marriage could happen. They wanted to take him out anyway, and so they went in there.
We'll have to leave it at that. With our thanks to our guest, Steve Yateev, he's professor of political science at Old Dominion University. You might look for his forthcoming book, The Absence of Grand Strategy, The U.S. and the Persian Gulf, 1972-2005, coming from Johns Hopkins later on this month. Professor Yateev, we want to say thanks very much to you for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Support for the broadcast today comes from Provena Medical Group, where doctors treat people, not illness. More information available at 1-866-PROVENA. The physicians of Provena Medical Group encourage you to join them in supporting WILO. Support also comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, 6th and University in Champaign, for over 15 years providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of name brand foods from around the world. Your suggestions, requests, always welcome. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. We're going to break for an update on the markets. Stay tuned.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where let's jump right in with the prices. In Kansas City, May wheat now at 11.80 and a quarter, down 19 and three quarters. At the Board of Trade, May wheat at 10.40 and one quarter, and now at 10.40, up 8.5. July, 11.08, up 6. May corn, 546 and a half, up 7 and a quarter. July, 558 and a quarter, up 7. December at 560, up 5. May beans, 1303, up a quarter. July, 1318, down 3 quarters. August, 1310, down 1. November, 1226, now 1229, and it is unchanged. May soybean meal, 330.80, up $7. July,